Good morning, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Closer's Inner Circle podcast, hosted by your partner in Success Radio. I am your host, Denise Griffiths, and together with my co-host, Ben Gay III, we're diving into the world of sales mastery with a gem from The Closer's Part 2. It's my favorite book. These books, Parts 1 and 2, are widely known as the Sales Bibles, and today is a continuation of the past three shows, where Ben and I have been opening up the second largest chapter in the book called And Another Thing. And last week, we explored page 222, and today we open it back up to page 230. And if you don't already have these books in your entrepreneurial library, Ben will share where you can buy them at the end of the show. Good morning, Ben. It's Wednesday. It's always my favorite day of the week.
Good morning to you. I'm glad you survived the eclipse. And
I missed it. I don't think it came past my house.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
I heard everybody was like, you didn't see it? Well, I didn't look. I was busy.
Yeah, I'm with you.
So no, I didn't see it.
I have friends at NASA, and they notified me not to worry if I missed it, because the sun was going to go down at its usual time that night and would be gone for about 10 hours. So I could have the full experience.
Every day. I had some people ask me on Facebook, where are you going to watch it? YouTube. I'll let other people scorch their retinas. I'm not real interested.
If it's important, it'll come up on the news. And it did, endlessly, for 2 days.
Yeah, I don't understand that. It's not as if these are a new phenomenon at all. Yeah. But, you know, the news has to make up crap. So I guess this was their choice for the week.
The slogan in news is, if it bleeds, it leads. And on days you don't have anything bleeding, you go with the eclipse.
Anything to rile people up. So what are we talking? Speaking of storms and eclipses, I mean, you were telling me that you had a giant sonic boom of thunder come over your house. And then this morning, I honestly thought I was in a storm that was going to be worse than a hurricane, because it popped up around 3 o'clock in the morning. And honestly, I still don't know if it was hail or rain. I was not sticking my head out those French doors to get clobbered with hail. Yeah, I did retain that much sense, but it honestly sounded like my back windows, my whole back of my house is all windows. I genuinely thought my windows were cracking. It was so bad. It's over now, and it seems to have passed for at least a short term, but oh my goodness.
The first time I took Gigi to Atlanta, she'd heard a lot of stuff about the South, but had not experienced any of it, including sweet tea, good barbecue, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Grits. She'd never had grits.
Well,
I don't know how you get through life without having grits.
Yeah, shrimp and grits.
Yeah. Perfect. My mother was in a restaurant one day, and she's mother was from New England. She was not a big fan of grits. She said she would not have a grit in her house. So I had to eat grits at friends' homes. But she said to a waitress, I'd like so-and-so and so-and-so, and no grits, please. And the waitress says, honey, grits come. It's like a religious experience.
You can't avoid them.
Yeah.
You can cover them up with other stuff, and a lot of people do, but I like grits.
Yeah,
don't
I do
go
too.
Deal, but I like grits.
Just butter, salt, and pepper for me is perfect. But grits come.
Don't argue with the waitress.
I'd like to stop them, but there's no way to stop them.
It's like sweet tea. I don't drink it. I don't touch it. It's nasty. I don't like sugar. And here, you have to ask for just plain old-fashioned, straight-up tea. It offends some people. They're like, you don't like sweet tea? Oh, my God, no. Yeah, I accidentally, you know, got a big sip of it one day, and I'm ashamed to say I spit it back out. It was not going past my tonsils.
Well, that was classy.
I know, and I was in a restaurant. I was very embarrassed, but I could not do. I'm shuddering just thinking about it. So anyway, I just blah. So anyway, let's talk about where we were, because I mean, this is the biggest chat. Well, sales infiltration is the largest chapter, and we're going to definitely get to that at some point. But this is one of the bigger chapters, and I suspect we're going to be working in this one for a while. What do you think?
A lot of stuff there. It caused this run we've been having caused me to go back and really reread it, which I don't do every morning. I was several times I said to myself, "Self, damn, that'd be good."
Isn't that, I'll see something written on Facebook or LinkedIn or wherever. It's like, oh, that's good. Oh, good girl, Denise. You didn't know you were that smart, did you?
Yeah, I have a few of those from time to time. Somebody sent me something once and I said, "That's excellent." And whoever it was wrote back, "Well, I'm glad you feel that way. It came from the closers page so and so and so and so." You know, I haven't memorized it. I write stuff and move on.
Right. Well, speaking of the closers, I have to tell you before I forget, I started writing one of my chapters about midnight last night. Woke up at 3 because my house was falling apart. But the chapter title is "You're Making This Way Too Hard." So there you have it. Okay, let's talk about the closers.
Okay, but before leaving that up, rather than leave that hanging, I want to tell our listeners, Denise has taken on the challenge of writing the closers part 4, and it's going to be on podcasting, all aspects, how to get started, what to do, what not to do, how to be a good guest, how to be a good host, etc., contacts to use, and so on. And she has, starting from nothing, I always get the year wrong, 16, 17, 18 years ago.
16.
How many?
16. She's old enough to drive now.
Has built a podcast that's in the top 2% in the world. So when the closers part 4 comes out, be sure and get a hold of it if you have any interest in podcasting, which is, I reluctantly have come to assume, is the wave of not only the past, but currently and the future. I grew up with one channel in Atlanta that came on at 5 o'clock.
You know, did it go off at midnight?
And went off at midnight with a bluebird of paradise singing, playing in the background. And then we went to 3 channels and so on. And I don't know how many podcasts there are now, but if you want to get heard, you can do it easily. If you want to get heard and be effective and successful at it, you need a mentor. And Denise Griffiths is that mentor. So be on the lookout. We'll announce it to everybody. But the closers part 4 is underway. And this is spontaneous, Denise. If you have anything you would hope would be in it that you're wondering about podcasting, contact Denise and tell her, because you can give her probably some ideas.
Yeah. See, I know what I think you need, but I need to hear from you what you really need.
Yeah. What I needed to be successful in podcasting was your phone number.
Let's tell that story real quick, because you tricked me. It's very neat and it was very tidy, but, and I'm trying to paraphrase here, but on LinkedIn I see a little snippet. We were talking, somebody was talking about podcasting, and here's Ben, sweet, adorable Ben, saying, you know, I would love to be a podcast, have a podcast, but I just don't know how to do it. And maybe I could be a co-host. My arm shot up. I think I have a rotator cuff injury. me, pick me. It's like, and I could hear you, see you, you know, just, you know, rubbing your hands in glee going, I got her.
Yeah, that didn't take long.
It's like, you can be my co-host. Let's do this. It was ridiculous. But here we are, a year later.
I had a 30-minute sales presentation ready, and
you did.
You
not.
Said do it. No, I didn't, but I was ready. I was cocked and ready in case you needed some selling.
No, but I didn't need any selling. I was like, seriously, I think I hurt my shoulder. Me.
You said before we get into the book, you said you had a question from somebody, and we sometimes don't pay much attention to the questions. About script chunks, was that what it was?
Yeah, it was. I had somebody email me and say, listen, I've been listening to you and Ben for quite a while now, and you guys are I want to say he said fascinating, but what he said was, you are funny. It's like, okay, we'll take that. But he said, what does Ben mean by script chunks? He said, you know, I've heard you talk about scripting. I've heard you talk about script chunks, but he said, I think I might have missed what that really means in terms of sales, in terms of persuasion. What are those?
Well, a script, as everybody knows and claims not to like, those people who've never been to the movies or watched a television program or seen a comedy routine, don't believe in scripting, not knowing that they've spent their whole life watching people do scripts beautifully. And if they've been selling over 30 days, they're on a script themselves. That's not the question. The question is it a good script? Is it a tested script? Is it an effective script? And that's where the fork in the road comes. So I encourage people to get good at scripting, test it, adjust, especially in the early days. The first one you write won't be right, but it might be close, and be open to adjusting it and correcting it and so on. But I think what people say when they don't like scripting is they're picturing someone going, hi, my name is Ben Gay, and talking for 40 minutes and then asking for the order. There is a place for that in opportunity meetings and group presentations. And when you go to your county fair, that wasn't the first time that guy explained the Ginsu knife. And if you stay there a few minutes, you'll hear him explain it again, word for word, exactly. But here's what a script chunk is. I rarely give the same presentation beginning to end, but I give it in chunks. In other words, if you ask me about the closers part two, I don't say, yes, we have a closer series and it starts with part one and sales closing power, the book I did for J. Douglas Edwards, and then it goes blah, blah, blah. I go right to the part that describes the closers part two, because that's what they asked for or what they needed. And the best example I've ever had about script chunks, where I not learned the term, but found a way to explain it, was Hal Holbrook, the late Hal Holbrook, the actor who, in addition to many other things, did Mark Twain. And he had I think it was an hour and a half, 2 hour presentation with a break in the middle, where he did Mark Twain word for word. But you could go back to the show night after night and get a similar but different show, because he claimed he never gave the exact same show twice in all the years he did it, because he had memorized 9.5 hours of Mark Twain material, word for word. And how you reacted to one story determined what the next story was you heard. For instance, he opened with a specific story. It was like a meat temperature probe. Opened with the same story every show, every night for years, and then would listen intently to the audience's reaction to that story. Good, bad, mediocre, giggling, roaring, whatever. And that would determine the second story he told. And that's how come he said, other than the first story, he never gave the same presentation twice, because the audience never reacted exactly the same twice. So you get an hour and a half and or 2 hours of pure Mark Twain material, but never in the same order. Never all of it. He said he couldn't find an audience who would sit still for 9 hours of him doing Mark Twain, but many audience, thousands of audiences were willing to sit still for an hour and a half or 2 hours because he was so good at it. And every word that came out of his mouth was scripted, word for word, but you just didn't know what chunk you were going to get next. He opened with the same story every time. I open, I have a scripted introduction that whoever's introducing me is to read. I don't need them improvising when I'm about to do my thing. So they read the introduction. It's well written. It almost always gets a standing ovation, as he says, and, you know, here he is, Ben Gay. And I walk on stage, pause for just a second, and then I say, let's get this Ben Gay thing out of the way. And that's my test story. if they don't laugh much, among things it teaches me is this is a younger crowd, not all of them, and they have many other options other than Bengay the ointment now. When I was growing up, they didn't use Bengay or Sorbine Junior. Those were basically the two products. So everybody knew it. So if it doesn't get much of a laugh, I either plunge on, or if it's really weak, I say, for those of you under 30, let me explain to you that there's this product called Bengay. It's a back rub, an ointment, and I explain it to them, and then they sort of in on the joke. But it's my way of testing the age of the audience, the astuteness of the audience. Are they paying attention, et cetera? And that determines the next story or example they hear. I've got, it's not all word for word, but I have how to sell and be successful in life in a 10-day seminar. I also have it in a 5-day version, a 3-day version, a 2-day, a 1-day, a half day, a 1-hour, et cetera, version. And how you react and the time I was given is determines what's the next story you hear. For I'll give you a little follow-up. And if you ever come to one of my sessions, be sure and react appropriately, people. I'm a very sensitive person.
Yes, honest.
I say, let's get this Bengay thing out of the way. And then I go on to say, it's actually worse than that. It's Benjamin Franklin Gay the Third. And people ask me, is there a Bengay the Fourth? And I say, well, my wife and I argued about that back and forth for quite some time. You shouldn't put that burden on him. If he doesn't have a good sense of humor, it'll be a nightmare, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I said, we finally, it was either Bengay the Fourth or what we named him, Absorbing Junior. See?
That's wrong. I would have called him Quattro.
One of my dear friends, one of my early mentors, Merle Frazier, does, and he calls me Trey.
Yeah. So, I was waiting for that.
Yeah. So but anyway. Yeah,
I'm so glad we're talking about this, you know, these script chunks, because it occurred to me some time ago, but I didn't know that these were script chunks, because I've been doing this podcast for a long time. But it occurred to me when this question popped up, and we've chatted about it a bit, but for some reason it never settled in my brain. But I realized at some level many years ago that I would get people on the show. It's a conversation. We're going back and forth. And I could ask them any kind of question I want because I'm listening. I don't do gotcha questions or stilted questions, but I'm going to have questions. And almost unfailingly, they pick up a script chunk and run with it. I didn't know that.
Well,
but they're condensing years of experience into an hour with me. They have to be on their game. I had no idea what to call it. That's going in the book, by the way.
Well, in podcasting, script chunks could be crucial because you got time limits. You know, I can get up and wander around, and depending on the schedule, I always am respectful if there's a speaker before me or after me or what have you. But given my own free will, I can just wander and talk about things for hours. I'm a Southerner. We tell stories. And so it in podcasting, especially, your discipline. I mean, you've got an hour or whatever, and it's got all your questions, their answers, your responses have all got to fit within that hour. That would be an excellent time for one or both of you to be using script chunks.
Mm-hmm.
And they're terribly effective. I had a couple of friends who went to see a friend. Well, they're all dead. I can talk about them now. Ray Considine, who wrote the great book Waymish, Waymish, which stands for, reminds me of something you said before we got on the air. Why are you making it so hard, .. for me to give you my money? Salespeople have a tendency to get in the way of a customer spending money with them. And Wade Cannon, who was a human behavioral psychologist and a wonderful guy, vice president of the Wilson Learning Company, in Minneapolis. And as I said, they've both gone to their great rewards, as has the person I asked him to go see. I said, I've got a dear friend, Danny Cox, and you'll really like him. He's a funny guy, former fighter pilot. He was called a sonic boom salesman. He would go out to communities and explain to them why it was important that the overhead jets blew out their windows and startled them and scared them to death and so on, because of it's good for the nation, you know.
Oh, yeah, that works.
Send us the bill for your window and we'll be happy to pay it. But in the meantime, we're practicing defending you. So that's what made him the sonic boom salesman. So anyway, I hooked up the three of them. I wasn't going to be in that town. And they went out to dinner the night before, and Ray was telling me later, he said, it was wonderful. He's a funny guy. Wade and I felt like we had the night off because they're both sort of performers themselves and are used to, you know, here's Ray Considine, the funniest man in the world. Be funny, Ray. And, you know, here's Wade Cannon, a wise, all-knowing, all-seeing soul. Be wise, Wade. And they felt like they had a night off because Danny, given the opportunity, ran with the ball for about 2 hours, and he said this and said that, and they cracked up and so on. And then the next morning they went to the seminar for which I'd gotten them tickets, and went in, and Ray and Wade started sneaking glances at each other because they heard from the stage with a microphone and a large audience Danny give his dinner talk again.
Oh, that's just wrong.
He said no matter what happened in the audience, he plunged on with the next story, and it got where I, you know, raised lean over to Wade and says, you know, here comes the time the engines burned out story. And, you know, Danny say, and then one day I was flying along, you know, and he goes to the burned out engine story. So another secret of script chunks is to work on them, and your whole script, work on it so it's casual and nice, and you're not caught. Cary Grant, the great actor, said the secret of acting was not to get caught at it. That's also the secret of selling, and therefore scripting. Do it well, and don't get caught at it.
I love that. And, you know, we have talked about this before, but just all of a sudden, you know, you get those arrows that kind of point at you and go, Denise, hello. You know, I get those all the time.
You get it this time?
Yeah, get off my head. I got it. I got it. But script chunks has, and then here comes this guy wanting to know more. I went, well, that's interesting. So, you know, these things happen for a reason. There are no real coincidences. So in the book, though, and you were going to twist off a little bit because we haven't talked about this chapter much, but I know what your customers want. Let's talk about that, because that seems like a pretty strong statement.
Well, there's things that pop to your mind if you're a salesperson. They want what's good for them, find a need and fill it, and so on. Those are all product related, product or service related, and they're fine. And they certainly have their place. It's not true, but remember the old adage, build a better mousetrap and the world will beat a path to your door. That's not true. Sounds good. Sounds funny. It's quotable, repeatable, but it's not true. Nothing happens, to quote Elmer Wheeler. Nothing happens till somebody sells something. But in selling them something, you better find out what it is they want. They want, hopefully, if you've described it properly, the benefits that your product or service brings to them. That's fine. Qualify them, question them, find out what those benefits are. But in the back of your mind, understand their motivating factors and what they really want. And at laid out in the book, I'll take the easy way and just glance down. They're looking for recognition, among other things. Recognition. I think it comes from How to Win Friends and Influence People. But Mary Kay, who after she left us started her own cosmetic company, you may have heard of it.
Yes, the Pink Lady, right?
Yeah, the Pink Lady.
Cadillacs.
A dear friend of mine, a male, did very well in Mary Kay and won a pink Cadillac. And he called me, he said, would it be rude to say I don't want a pink Cadillac? I was like, a black one? I said, that's between you and Mary Kay. I'm not stepping in between you. They were both very strong-willed people. But anyway, Mary Kay said, everyone you meet, and my apologies again to Dr. Norman Vincepiel if he's the one who said it first, pardon me, Dale Carnegie, if he said it first. Everyone you meet, she said, treat them this way, as if they have a sign around their neck that says, make me feel important. So while you're selling your widget and explaining its many features and hopefully even more benefits, understand that the person that you're looking at wants, in addition to those benefits, he or she wants recognition. They want to believe that they're a very important person, or at least that you think they're a very important person. And they will do that with things like their investments, their jobs, their cars, their houses, et cetera, trying to get recognized. I don't know about you, but we have a lovely home or homes, two on one piece of property, and they have, I think, six bedrooms total. I haven't really counted them in this way, five bathrooms, I'm guessing. And, you know, all the stamp, two kitchens, et cetera. We live in two rooms. We don't need all of that. There was a time when we did, when Gigi's mother was alive and she lived in the guest house and so on. But we don't need all that. I could be very happy in a small condominium somewhere where somebody else worried about the lawn and the roof and the this and the that. But somewhere along the line, having the nicest home in the neighborhood appealed to me. That's recognition. I didn't get my first Corvette or my first Cadillac or my first Mercedes, etc., because I needed one of those cars to get from point A to point B. You can do that in an old beater car. And depending on your personal economy, probably a better idea. Wealthy people, rich people sometimes act different because it comes on suddenly and they don't understand what went into it. Wealthy people, by and large, buy used cars. The car that was really popular and expensive 2, 3, 4 years ago.
I always buy a 2-year-old car because somebody else had to deal with all the breakdowns and the problems.
Yeah, the warranty recalls and so on. And somebody else had to deal with the 50-60% reduction in value.
There you go.
So I've bought and or leased primarily to give away over 600 luxury cars. I have bought past tense, my last new luxury car. If I need a car to impress you, we have an enterprise car rental thing about 8 blocks from our house. I can rent something to impress you. But
make it a Maserati and get your picture taken in front of it and tell people how important you are.
Yeah, one of our nephews-in-law, I guess you'd call him, one of our nieces married an idiot who inherited some money. And rather than invest it and be settled for the rest of his life, he went out and bought a Maserati. And now he's looking at also a Lamborghini. I have never bought either one or given away either one, so I don't have any idea of their cost, but I understand they're very expensive, and he bought them new. That's stupidity on the hoof, but I understand what he was looking for, recognition. I know what I felt like the first time I drove down the main street in San Rafael, California, where American graffiti was shot in my then new 1972 Corvette. People were looking at the car, and then some of them actually knew me because we were the largest private employer in the area. You know, look at that car. Oh, that's Ben Gay and so on. And it was all I could do not to puff up and float out of the car. That's recognition. And so you need to know where they are in their social development. You may not need the recognition or even want the recognition, but they do. And another item that we touch on in the book, understand why you're selling them your widget. They want to be respected, either from you respecting them, and not either, it's both, you respecting them or so on, or the product or service, the respect it will bring them for being a wise person, a smart person, a successful person or whatever. And we can go on. Some of them are a little more shallow. And if your product or service is going to give them a feeling of pride, make sure you point that out to them. When I was sold the Corvette by my dear friend, Herc, who owned the Marin Bay Lincoln Mercury dealership, he described it was a T-top, you know, where the hard tops go behind the seat and only come out when you're being rained on heavily in San Francisco. I discovered that the hard way several times. He described the wind in my hair. And Ben, when you drive down the street, people are going to notice this car and so on. He appealed to my pride. He spent almost no time talking about the benefits or lack of benefits or features of the Corvette. You could look at it. It's a pretty car. It was the last year with chrome bumpers. And the T-top was amazing. Everybody loves a convertible until the top rips and so on with the T-top. You don't have that problem. So he talked about the pride of owning it, the pride of ownership, and so on. They also, people want to belong. You get a Corvette. I didn't, I'm proud to say, but if you get a Corvette, you are looking for the local Corvette club so you can belong to it and go on drives with it and go to Main Street in where we live now in Placerville. They have old car nights a couple times a year. They also have Corvette nights where you walk down the street and there's 50 or 60 Corvettes. People, it always, I want to go over to the people and say, what do you get out of this? You have to clean your car, drive down here, back it in, have people come by and look at it while everybody's looking at their Corvette and so on. I don't quite get it, but I do understand the need to belong. In the timeshare industry, I'm working with several companies to get them to spend less time talking about the week that you get or the 2 weeks or what have you, and more time talking about the jacket that you wear as a member, and that you can go to any timeshare. You can go to any timeshare in their network for dinner or whatever. But you have the jacket. Think of the Masters is coming up, I believe. I've seen a lot about it on television last week or so. So it's spring. So the Masters is about to come to Augusta, Georgia. Think Masters. What do you think? Great
green
golf
jacket.
And the green jacket.
Right. People, even I know that, and I don't watch golf.
Yeah, and that's
I
not
can
just
do the golf clap, though. I have mastered that.
And that's not just for the Masters winners. Every member of Augusta National gets to wear the green jacket. And I don't know what the current entry fee is, but I suspect it's $250,000 or more. I'll get corrected quickly if I'm wrong. But $250,000 or wrong. It's a golf course. It's a lovely golf course, but most people don't play well enough to take advantage of the lovely golf course. Might as well be the American Legion Club. But they get to say they're a member of Augusta National, Bobby Jones course. He also belonged to ours, East Lake Country Club in Atlanta. And I rarely mention East Lake without saying Bobby Jones home course. I was a kid. I wasn't the member, but I was a member through my mother and father. But we were members of East Lake back then, Country Club. They now call it Golf Club. And I say, I was raised two gates out the front door of East Lake Country Club, front gate of East Lake Country Club, Bobby Jones home course. I'm insinuating myself into 100-year plus legacy of great golf, famous people, famous tournaments, and so on. And I'm stunned. Maybe they have it now, but when I was growing up and belonged to East Lake, they didn't have a jacket. Bobby Jones belonged to East Lake. Bobby Jones started Augusta National. he and his associates decided on the green jacket and who could wear it. And East Lake didn't have one. And East Lake is very expensive to get into. Now, it was adjusted backwards for inflation then, but very expensive to get into. Give me one of those things on raising money for kids. I think it's Shriners. You see it on television, this little child who now is in college and drives a hand-operated car, but in the commercials, he's still 7 or 8 years old. I guess it's been effective for him. If you pledge X number of dollars a month, $18, $19 a month, they send you, quote, this adorable blanket. Well, this adorable blanket never leaves your bedroom. The adorable, handsome hat they might send you with a Shriners logo on the front could well be worth a great deal more emotionally as far as belonging when you go out. Hi, I'm a good guy. I give to Shriners. They have the Shriners Children's Hospital. I'm a member. I give to them regularly or I wouldn't have this hat. That's belonging. Give them a way to participate. I saw a guy, I'm thinking about getting one for Jimmy Rucker and me. We went in the Coast Guard together, went through school together, Coast Guard together, first business partner, et cetera, getting custom Coast Guard caps with Cuba Patrol written beneath the logo. Because we were on the Cuba Patrol right when Kennedy and Khrushchev were facing off with nuclear weapons, and we all thought maybe it'd be the end of the world.
Yeah.
And I take some pride in that. I didn't do anything heroic. I just did what I was told. But it was interesting. We got buzzed by Cuban MiGs and so on. And I thought, I see people out with those, you know, World War II veteran hats on. And I think, you know, I'd like to wear one. I'm not really a hat person, but I'd like to have one that says Coast Guard. And I know Jimmy Rucker would like one because it shows that we belong, as it's covered on page 233, we belong to something important. And then the other day at the post office, I got pushed over the edge. I'm ordering them. There was a guy in there, older than I am, with his World War II veteran hat on. And he had the fancy version, you know, with the braids on the thing, like he's an admiral or something. And he had pins stuck all over it, I guess, various things he had done or served in. And he looked like $1 million, and the hat was not your 1995 hat. And so I went over to him, as I always do with people like that, and said, sir, thank you for your service.
Exactly.
And frequently they'll say, did you serve? Which could be a rude question, but I did. So I say, yes, sort of. And that always elicits, what do you mean, sort of? And I said, well, I was in the Coast Guard, you know, those little white boats up close to the shore, because we didn't like to get our feet wet. And the older, wiser people will say, no, I served with Coast Guardsmen. I know what a lot of you did, and you don't get credit for it and so on. So I mean, I'm looking at this hat, and I'm thinking, I may get that thing and surprise Rucker with it. I hope Rucker's not listening. That'll take a little
I was
bit.
Just going to say, hey, Jimmy.
Yeah. Hat's on the way, Jimmy. But anyway, as we're parting, he says, oh, let me tell you one other thing about this hat. I said, what's that? He said, you never have to buy a drink again.
Or coffee.
Yeah,
or a meal.
Or breakfast.
Or whatever.
And I said, that's it. I'm getting it. Gigi said, well, the one you were looking at is $49, $50 for a baseball cap. I said, I'll get it back in drinks and breakfast within a week.
You will, too.
Probably so.
Listen, when I see people like that, you know, I'm a card-carrying introvert, although when I'm out in public, you'd never know it. But honestly, when I see people like that, I want to hear their stories. I'll sit down and have a cup of coffee with them.
Absolutely. The ones I'm Vietnam era age. I was in Cuba or off the shore of Cuba when that was going on. But I know people who died in Vietnam. I know many people who served in Vietnam. And I know the atrocious reception that many of them got when they came back.
Yeah,
so when I see a
that's
Vietnam,
a blight on our history, no question.
Yeah. When I see a Vietnam cap, I'm even more effusive than I am with a World War II cap. death is death, hell is hell, and so on. But to go through that and then come home and be spit on and cursed at and so on. Among the things I say to him is I was Coast Guard Vietnam era off Cuba. So I didn't get the treatment you did, but on behalf of a grateful nation, we're sorry.
And we are. I've
So,
heard those stories. I've read those stories, and they just, I don't understand it. I will never understand that kind of inhumanity.
Yeah, and it wasn't, some volunteered out of patriotism. One of my cousin-in-laws was one of the youngest officers, high-ranking officers in the Marine Corps, served in Vietnam, and he was in North Vietnam three or four times where we didn't have any people, but we had him and his group and so on. And I just admire what they did so much. Now, he was a warrior. He would have been mad if they hadn't sent him to Vietnam. But most of the people who went were not leaping up and down trying to get shot at in a jungle. They did what they were supposed to do. They did what they were told. They didn't flee to Canada. Then they came back and got spit on. It to this day, it just boils my blood.
I don't think you're alone in that.
Yeah, hopefully I'm not. I feel it changing because when they first came back, they wouldn't have been wearing the veteran's hat. I see them treated graciously and well, sometimes by people who didn't know Vietnam was controversial. You know, they just know they serve somewhere. I see little kids go over and said, "Thank you for your service, sir." And they don't really know what they're thanking them for, but they know this is an important
It's
person.
important,
And
right?
all of that, everything we've said in the last 10 or 15 minutes stems from everyone you've ever met wants to belong. They want to belong to something bigger than they are individually, better than they are individually, et cetera. So figure out a way to give them the green jacket or some of the Corvette Club confession to show you how I've grown and matured. When I got my first new car, a 1962 Volkswagen, I got an invitation in the mail to join the Volkswagen Club of America. And I did. I didn't go to any meetings, but I honked at other bugs when I saw them coming at me on the street. I honked at them. And I remember thinking, I've got a VW bug. I belong to something.
I felt that way when I got my Range Rover. You know, we all kind of nod at each other. It doesn't matter how old or how beat up it is. We all recognize each other. Like, hey, how you doing? It's hilarious.
You too got one.
I did.
Well,
Still do.
That's belonging, and that's important because, again, glancing down, people buy for hope of reward or fear of loss. Oversimplified, there's other things, but hope of reward or fear of loss. A hope of reward, and you can give it to them while you're selling to them, includes recognition, respect, pride, better ways of doing things, and belonging. And as an old Southerner who used to play golf, if by joining or winning the Masters, I got a green jacket, I don't think I'd ever take it off. I try and get two, one to sleep in and one to wear out outside. I mean, that's just the ultimate.
The whole time you're talking about green, I'm kind of flinching because I can't even stand next to green without looking sallow or yellow. Green is not my color at all. But, you know, when you said that about the jackets, and I just went, what? You're talking about the timeshare. I had no idea. I had no idea at all that that was a thing. And I did know about golf. I mean, who doesn't? Even I know about golf, and I don't watch any kind of sports. But it's fascinating that you are able to equate that all to belonging. I had no idea.
It's a crucial human motivator. You
It
want to
is.
belong to the cool kids in high school, being part of the cool kids, or at least not one of the, God forbid, nerds who today run the country and own all the big companies. You know, thank God for the nerds. I was watching someone the other day on the show, and just a brainiac. And I said to Gigi, successful as he is, that's the jackass who used to ask on Friday afternoon, don't we have any homework for the weekend?
I didn't do that, but I was a nerd. Only because I didn't speak to anybody else, so I got to live. But yeah, and you watch these kids now, and they're proud of it. Weedy body type, floppy hair, and big glasses. They don't care. They know they're smart.
Well, true, but they're belonging now. There is a crowd that's popular that is that, and that's they're trying to belong to it. I didn't get a flat top because it was my idea when I was a kid. It was because the cool kids had flat tops, and I wanted to belong. And then when Elvis came along, I grew DuckTales.
Oh, you're going to have to tell Gigi I want pictures. I know she knows where they are. I know she does.
There's one I haven't found yet. I think it's probably in the St. Andrews Prep School annual for 1959 or 1960. I got thrown out of school. I ran away and got thrown out as a result of St. Andrews, and I never got my annual. But that was the year that somebody thought it would be a good idea in our dorm. I had blonde hair, now I have white hair. It would be a good idea to all have jet black hair. And I have a pale Irish complexion. You can imagine how good I looked in my jet black hair, dyed with a product called Blue Black Roux.
Oh God, did you have a cape with a red,
That was
like
the only thing
red
missing. Yeah, and I should have gotten the fangs.
lining? Thanks. Yeah. I'm thinking in word pictures now. I'm enjoying myself. Keep going.
But somebody, his last name was Autry, was sort of the trendsetter in our dormitory. He was the cool one. And he dyed his hair black. And so rather quickly, I got my hands several on a bottle of Blue Black Roux. We dyed our hair black. And then we noticed that most of it still had blonde eyebrows. So as best we could, we drew in, like
Oh
with
no.
one of those dabbers, dabbed in the black eyebrows. I gotta find that picture.
You do. I want it, and I won't even share it, honest.
So yeah, right. Picture me, black. I sort of say, when you went out in the sun, our hair did that purple thing like the chest on a black crow. It's black and then it's purpley and so on. It really looked natural.
I'm sure. And when you sweated, did it kind of run down behind your ears and in your ears and
It
in your eyes?
probably did in the beginning, but Blue Black Roux is a serious dye. It
Oh,
does, you don't
gosh.
rinse it out, it grows out. So then you go through that period where your roots and halfway up to the tips of your hair are blonde and the rest is black. It looks like you've come down with some disease. But the re in addition to being a cute story, the point of the story is, why did I do it? Because I wanted to belong. I wanted to be like Bill was his first name. I wanted to be like Bill Autry, and rather quickly, like 10 other people in my dorm. And all those people, I was the funny one, but I wasn't an athlete and so on. So I needed every edge I could get to belong. And Blue Black Roux solved that problem for about a month. Then it became another problem as it grew out and fell out and so on. But all of this that we've been talking about is the need to belong to something. Figure out a way to have, you and I have used the term the Closers Inner Circle podcast. Inner circle is an important part of how I brand myself and so on. There are certain groups that I work with who can say, honestly, because I told them, you're in the inner circle. I have, we're expanding our makeup of certified speakers for and trainers, sales trainers, and human potential trainers, and so on, in the National Association of Professional Salespeople. I sat back one day and said, I really don't want to have to go out and train I've done that, you know, the 10-day trainings, the 30-day trainings. So I really don't want to do that anymore. But I want people to display the approved by the National Association of Professional Salespeople seal of approval and spread
Which
the word.
I have it.
You do, and you earned it. And the way I've decided to do it in mass, there's individual people like you who was one-on-one, Denise. You've been nominated and approved, and here it is, and here's your seal, and so on, which, by the way, you should use more on your promotional material. But so what I'm doing now, and it's amazing the reaction, approved 4 or 5 yesterday from the Ziegler organization. Zig and I started together literally on the same day in the same meeting in Atlanta, making big money. He was older than I was, but he hadn't had a heavy hit yet. And so we started together, and now he's gone. His son Tom is running the organization. So I have a long history with Ziegler, and I know what they teach and I know how good it is. So I'm slowly letting the word loose in the Ziegler organization. If they've certified you, you're certified here too. You can put up the NAP seal of approval in those things that have to do with selling, human development, and so on. And I sort of wondered what the reaction would be. It's been tremendous. I think everyone that I've offered it to has accepted it. Why? They want to belong. They want to have another seal. It helps their business too, but they want to belong. They want to have a seal that they're in something special that other people can't get. If your product or service delivers that, make sure they know it. So wrapping up this section, they're looking for recognition, respect, a feeling of pride. They want to show how intelligent they are. They want to be right. They want to do better. Whatever the product or service it is you offer delivers to them, they want to be better and be better. They want to belong. And back to hope, reward, and fear of loss, they want to be rewarded and not to lose. But, you know, we talk about all the fancy stuff. When the dust settles, the customer wants to know what's in it for me. And I hope I don't lose anything. And I hope I benefit. Hope or reward, fear of loss. And that pretty, you know, that's that last little segment plus about 2 other sentences is the 10-day seminar boiled down. One of the frustrating things about teaching selling to other people, especially 2 that are hard, the brand new ones who are scared to death and the old ones who are jaded, whether in age or time and service. Those are the 2 toughest to work with. Therefore, it's frustrating to try and teach them because selling is so simple. Pick a quality product or service that's competitively priced. Spend your day talking to qualified people, qualified to buy it, geographically, religiously, monetarily, whatever. Become a person of class, quality, and substance with the ability to tastefully project those qualities, and then study a few. If you read the closers, part 1 is The Better Seller. I've never really understood that. The closers part 2 is a better book. But if you read the closers 5 or 6 times and then once a year for the rest of your sales career, it's all there. It's simple. But people complicate it. Therefore, they can justify not taking any action because it's too complicated. They can follow their natural instincts to procrastinate, et cetera. And people at the front of the room have been saying, and I used to be one of them, now pay strict attention. It's very complicated. You say this, they say that. You say, and all you have to do is memorize 700 things they're going to say and 700 responses when they say it. No one's going to do that.
No. No, and why should they? It doesn't even make sense.
It does if you say it effectively from the stage. No. I got away with it for years.
I'd be arguing with you in the aisle. It's like, all right, explain this. Put it in Homer Simpson terms. One slower, one more long. I have to tell you, Ben, I was, you know, after this storm woke me up, and I swear I keep looking, you know, even still to see if my windows are cracked. But I was listening to Napoleon Hill's Master Course on Audible because, you know, who's going to go back to sleep in the middle of a giant storm? And I was listening to, you know, because you and I talk about him a lot. He mentored you until he passed away, which I understand still, you know, kind of irritates you that he just died on you, to put it in your words. And
Quote.
yeah, shame on him. But I was listening to this, and I hadn't actually ever listened to it. And there were times, I swear to you, I heard your voice in his demeanor. I could hear it.
I
It was
maybe
the
picked up
strangest
more than
thing.
I realized.
I
He's a
think you
he's
did.
also a southerner.
And I caught that too. And, you know, I had seen snippets of him on YouTube, and he said, oh, well, you know, he looks like my great grandpa. You know, I mean, I love to read Napoleon Hill, but I'd never really listened to him. This was a whole new journey for me, but I heard you in several things that he had to say.
Well, I probably borrowed them from him, or we both learned from fellow Southern mentors. But he was a true Southern gentleman, and we would spend hours swapping stories back and forth, hopefully and usually with a point to them. But one of the things people, I don't remember if we've discussed this or not, but one of the things people are always looking for the deep meaning in Think and Grow Rich, for instance. Laws of success, the law of success. About I know about two people on the planet who've read it. Dr. Hill probably read it as he wrote it, and maybe had to edit it. Mark Harris, my friend and business partner in some projects, knows as much about Hill's writing as Hill did. And beyond that, it gets real thin real quick. It was too long, too complicated. When it was first published, too expensive. In the midst of the depression, he comes out with a, I think, a 7-volume set that cost, in today's money, about $500, and it was a slow seller. Really? Duh. Of course it was. But then he boiled it down into Think and Grow Rich, which is readable, affordable, etc. And now whole careers, Bob Proctor, for instance, built an entire career on looking for the deep meaning in Think and Grow Rich. Dr. Hill told me one day over lunch, he said, it fascinates me. Everybody's looking for the deep meaning. The deep meaning is take action.
Right. You've said
And
that to me multiple times, and I've read this book, I don't know how many times. Once you told the, you know, you pointed that out, I went, oh, and I went back and I was like, there it is. There, God damn it, there it is too. I was teaching.
it is again.
Yeah. And I was saying bad words like Denise, dumb, stupid, dumb. It was all right there.
True, but you couldn't build a career looking for the answer if you knew the answer the first day. So it's probably
True.
better,
Yeah.
better that you read it. And the other thing he revealed, he said it's become a work of philosophy and deep meaning. He said, I wrote Think and Grow Rich as a sales training manual. This is what successful salespeople do, because that's who bought, still true today to a large degree, that's who buys self-improvement material. Sales and marketing people who are trying to get better so they can sell more of their products and services. So if you're looking for the deep meaning, it's a sales training manual, and take action. Sort of like
Right.
my thing of pick a quality product that's competitively priced and spend your time talking to people who can buy it. That's not real deep, but it's true. You know, well, I would rather sell a piece of junk where I have to mud wrestle with my client for 2 hours to get them to think that they'll, to get them to say they'll think it over. Why? You know, why? And I don't have to love the product. I can love what it does for people. I can love that they love it. But I don't, many of the things I've sold over the years, I don't need, I don't want, but I know why they do. And when possible, I've always owned what I sold. So I can say with mine, or when we're using our Electrolux vacuum cleaner, here's what we've discovered, or whatever. But I also sold coin-operated Pong games, the first video games ever. And I never had one, don't want one, don't want one for free. And they are available for free. I saw one at a garage sale the other day. It was Pong game sitting there. two-sided. I don't know if it worked or not. And it said free U-Haul. And I'm thinking,
Junk.
I was getting $1,500 for these things 30 years ago.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, you never know. And somebody will pick it and think they've got something so important. You never know. You just never know. I wanted to ask you, when did you start working with Dr. Napoleon Hill? Because my understanding of this particular course is he started, these were, I think, basically 17 seminars, speeches he gave in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm. I think that's where it came from.
Yeah.
Dr. Hill has what I call the magic desk. When he was working with me, or for me, actually, that sounds egotistical, but he did. I asked him numerous times, do you have anything else you want to publish? Because we had a big company, and you know, if I just published it, it was like when Clem Stone told everybody at Combined Insurance they had to read Think and Grow Rich. It made it a bestseller again, years after it had died a natural death. All I had to do was say, here's the new thing Dr. Hill wrote for us or with us or what have you. We did a big favor to Earl Nightingale. We did that with some of his material and the Wilson Learning Corporation and SMI and so on. He said, no, I'm pretty much done. But they just came. So I call it the magic desk. He's been dead 54 years and they keep finding things. I never went to his office in South Carolina, but I've often wondered how big must that office have been not to be able to find these things for 54 years. So I think some of it is, what's the word, apocryphal, things that sort of like what he would have written if he'd lived long enough. But they came out with something the other day that they said he wrote in 1967. 1967, to answer your question, is when he came to work for me or with me, when he started staying at the house. And I bought him a typewriter for the house. He was rather appalled because it was electric. And apparently the one back home in South Carolina was one of those, you know, you had to press down hard to make the key come up. But late into the night, I would sometimes hear tap, tap, tap. He was not one of the great typists of our time. And that was in 67. So maybe he wrote this new book they just found or revised or whatever, partially at my house. He didn't write at the office. We were busy, but he wrote at my house almost every night after we all said goodnight and went to bed. You'd hear the typewriter tapping. So I don't know, but 67 is the answer for me. He worked for me about 2.5 years and then died.
I wonder, I catch myself wondering, because you have always, you know, shared with me that you guys had a great relationship. Well, he was old enough, I think, to be your great-grandfather or your grandfather,
yeah,
at any rate, but
right,
great-grandfather. But you guys had a terrific, you know, relationship. You worked well together. And I catch myself wondering if he would take snippets from the conversations that y'all were having in those evenings and run with them.
Yeah, maybe I'll say with Ben Gay the Third on the
there
cover
you
of this
go.
new
See,
book.
That's where I was going.
Put it in the closers series.
Right.
There's the closers part six right there.
You have to wonder, because we don't live in a vacuum, and I'll hear something or think of something, and maybe 3 in the morning, it's like, oh, I got to write that down. And as you know, I call them God winks. I am willing to bet with all sincerity that he had a lot of God winks when he was with you.
And vice versa. He was really something, and gentle, but blunt. Take action, Ben. One time,
write it down, Ben. I love that.
Write it down. And I'm looking for something to write on. He said, Marty, to my assistant, secretary, whatever she was, the boss, get Mr. Gay some yellow pads. I've never been without them since. Big ones and little ones. I can see 4 from where I'm sitting right now. 3
You know who
little
else
ones.
does that? Our buddy, David Brown. He heard you talking about it with me on a show. He now is the proud owner of a whole bunch of yellow pads.
That and a pen clip to them. it does so much good, because we all have great ideas. Everybody has great ideas. But most people don't write them down, therefore they don't remember them, and therefore they don't take action.
Take action. That's so important. We are really close to getting cut off here. Do you have anything else you want to share with the audience before our
No,
next
I'm good.
episode?
If you're interested in my mentoring program, where I do for people what Dr. Hill did for me, shoot me an email at BFG3, the numeral 3, at directcon.net, and just put mentoring somewhere in it. You don't have to write a thesis, just mentoring, and I'll shoot you. No cost, no obligation, no follow-up phone calls. I will shoot you a written explanation of the mentoring program. Happy to do it for you. And if you don't have the closers, you shouldn't be listening to this broadcast if you don't have the closers. But if you don't, go to stores, STORES dot eBay dot com / all one word, Ronzoni Books, RONZONEBOOKS. They offer the closer series there for less money than I offer, and they put in free shipping, but they still bring them to me for signing and dating. So you lose nothing, you save money.
Excellent. What are we going to talk about next week? Are we going to continue in this chapter? Because we've got, we've got, gosh, quarter inch of pages here to keep work our way through.
I'm sorry we didn't get to it today. Let's start on page 234. Which one do you want? It's one of the great closes in history.
Perfect. And what you were talking about, there's a list, and I'm going to read them out very quickly because it's right above. Which one do you want? Recognition, which we've covered, respect, pride, to be right, to do better, to belong, to be rewarded, to not lose. These are human wants and needs that need filling, no question about it.
Absolutely.
I just made a note, and we will pick up next week. So listen, everybody, go find those books, the closers, part one and part two. At any rate, get those on your entrepreneurial library shelves. Mine's right there. I can see it. And thank you for joining. Oh, and Ben had mentioned, get in touch with me about the podcast book, because it is a sales book. Let's not lose sight of that. This is, the closers are sales books. We're going to be talking about sales, marketing, persuasion, how you can show up in a big world and get your voice heard. It's all about sales in many, many ways. And I know that sounds, I had to wrap my head around it. It's like, oh, but it is. So anyway, if you have questions or you need to ask me something that you just can't find an answer to, and I may not be able to find it, but I'll go find it, call me 888-719-6711, and you will help me write this book. And I appreciate it.
Repeat it again.
888-719-6711. It does not ring in my office. You'll have to leave a message, but your call will be returned just as quickly as possible, typically within that day or early the next day.
Or whenever she feels like it.
No. Dang it, Ben. Okay, here we go again. I want to talk to your wife. Anyway, everybody, thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to welcoming you to the Closers Inner Circle podcast next week. And get in touch with us. We are here to help. Talk to you later, Ben.
Bye.
Bye.